welcome back. And so we come to another more famous woman of our podcast's world. A darling of the screen, a famous recluse, the Swedish Sphinx, Greta Garbo.
I love that her nickname is such a tongue twister, but her star name is so clear.
There's a reason for that we'll get into. As Mercedes D'Acosta wrote in 1960, to really know Greta, one must know the North, wind, rain, and dark brooding skies.
Classic Swedes.
And so we begin our tale in Stockholm, Sweden in 1905. Born Greta Gustafsson, the girl the world would know as Greta Garbo was originally going to be adopted out to a more economically stable family. You see, her family was just scraping by between her father's day laborer bounce around gig and her mother's factory work. Greta was the third and youngest after an older sister and brother, and as it happens, her dad's employer knew of the financial troubles and offered to adopt the impending third child. However, her mother was resolute and said, "If God gives you a child, he also gives you bread."
Sure, we've seen how well that pans out historically.
I have supreme doubts about this statement, but there went the adoption plan. For the next 10 years, Garbo was known as Katta, because she couldn't pronounce her own name. Not that surprising in a family with very little education that lived on the brink of ruin. She later recalled it was as if there was danger in the air, especially when the 1909 labor strike crippled Sweden for several weeks.
Wow, do we know how that affected her?
Not well. Considering it's labor strikes, I imagine at least one parent is out of work for a good portion of time. To be honest, though, there aren't many descriptions of Garbo's childhood that she related. The most we get is, "It was eternally gray, those long winter nights. My father would be sitting in a corner, scribbling figures on a newspaper. On the other side of the room, my mother was repairing old clothes, sighing. We children would be talking in very low voices, or just sitting silently." This has led to speculation, despite Garbo saying she loved her parents, over whether there were fights about money, alcoholism, emotional abuse, so forth. The speculation isn't helped by her calling those years brutal, and the fact a journalist interviewing her once wrote, "That girl has been hurt, deeply, terrifically hurt. I wonder why it is."
Oof, that sounds like a rough childhood all around, regardless of how little we know.
Yeah, it does. This is not to say there were no childhood games. In fact, she was the ringleader of a group of neighborhood kids, and the one who came up with the games and stories making up environments like long sandy beaches and glamorous casinos amid the clotheslines and cramped streets. This extended into staging her own plays, which she press-ganged her siblings into. Despite that, she was frequently solitary, preferring to play alone. She said later that she never enjoyed playing with others, including her siblings, and preferred being alone with dolls and picture books. When she finally went to school, her solitary ways enhanced. Though, to be honest, I'd be surprised if any creative child did well in a system, harping on the Lutheran phrase, "Where sin is punished, God is honored and praised."
Oh no.
Sounds very dreary to me. So she coasted along, not putting in much effort by the sounds of it, but doing well enough. And then there was World War I. While Sweden was actually neutral, other nations looked at it with suspicion. Hence why the British blockaded it. Probably in part because Sweden insisted on the freedom to ship materials to all combatants, as it remained aloof of the fighting. Still, the blockading of foodstuffs to a place that far north is going to create a hungry, angry populace. Rationing was enforced, and soon soup kitchens run by the Salvation Army popped up everywhere. On the upside, singing at the kitchens earned Garbo a few coins. Aside from that, the war didn't affect her much. Come June 1919, Garbo finished school and got a job at a barber shop, which only somewhat helped her family, which now had her father missing work due to illness, and her brother and his ill pregnant wife. And there's just 7 people living in a cramped space with low wages.
I did have a question. What is her job at the barbershop? Is she a barber at this point?
No, she is essentially someone who's, like, prepping you for the barber. Like, water and towels.
Gotcha, okay.
To add to the misery, she returned home one day to find her father sweating up a storm from fever. And the charity hospital wouldn't take him because the family couldn't afford the treatment. He died a few days later.
The charity hospital wouldn't take him because the family couldn't afford treatment. What's wrong with this sentence?
A lot. But I also don't think much has changed.
Yeah. Things on our international to-do list, I guess.
Anyway, the official cause of death was inflammation of the kidneys. By this point, Garbo is only 14.
Oof.
As the family was dirt poor, she changed jobs to the more lucrative department store gig. Surprisingly, the job revealed that Greta was very good at watching people and then taking those observations and acting refined with good taste, essentially acting. The gig also afforded the ability to start in ads, and this is where we start with the actress the world came to know.
So when you say acting, this isn't just like photos of her that appear in magazines or something.
No. So when I say acting with the refined with good taste and whatnot, you have to imagine this is a peasant girl wearing rags or whatever, usually, now trying to sell rather middle-class-ish, upper-middle-class, maybe, clothes to people with a lot more money and education and taste.
And she's doing this in videos of herself, or?
No, she's doing this on the department floor. However, when it comes to the ads, it starts with photos and then moves, as we will see, to video. In fact, the director of one store promotional film offered Garbo her first role in a full-length film, but she had to turn it down because the store refused to give her time off. She eventually accepted a role with a different director and quit her store sales job after 2 years there when the manager again refused to give her 2 weeks off for the filming.
Now, what does her family think about all of this? I mean, this is quite the dangerous step from secure employment in the store to showbiz.
Surprisingly, her mother was all right with this. It might have had something to do with the pay, but I don't know for certain. Because you see, the film, Peter the Tramp, was low budget and filmed around Stockholm in a matter of weeks. After the filming ended, Garbo made the rounds of directors in the city, but nothing came of it. Instead, at 17, she ended up at a 2-year drama academy with the help of several actors she'd met in the previous months. Now, you may be asking how she afforded this.
Yeah, how exactly did she afford this?
She got a monthly stipend with her acceptance.
Wow, so they're actually saying, like, yeah, we will take people of lower classes, we will take people of less means. That's pretty impressive.
If they have the ability, the talent. It's also at the academy that she meets Mimi Pollack, who became her friend, possible crush, and the one who introduced her to smoking, a habit which Garbo never managed to quit for the rest of her life. Eventually, Greta received word that the director, Moritz Stiller, wanted her for a part in his new film. This came about from both the plays the students were to perform, which sometimes directors attended, and the teachers at the academy recommending different students to inquiring directors and friends in the business. When the two met, there was little small talk about the weather and such as he just looked her over. Face, body lines, eyelashes, weight, body, and facial movement. When he finally asked for her phone number, Garbo believed her interview was a failure.
I mean, I would. That sounds like he's just kind of ogling her.
It was not, in either case. He called later, which surprised her, and so she came to a supporting role in the saga of Gösta Berling.
What's Gösta Berling?
So the synopsis of the film is that a drunkard priest has been cast out by his community and then struggles to atone and regain his honor and dignity.
Oh, that sounds intense.
It seems very Swedish to me. Like there's stuff about the devil popping up and Garbo plays the new wife of some soldier, it sounds like.
Wild. That sounds like it's tapping into that religious sentiment that we were looking at before.
It does, and though I've only watched one actually Swedish movie, which oddly enough is the newer version of The Life of Queen Christina, it just sounds very Swedish to me. But back to Garbo. Despite a rocky start, because she took a long time to sell into the role, you see, Stiller noticed some hidden acting talent in her.
What does this mean exactly?
So when she's first on set and so forth, she's not the best. Like, she's very much dismissed by all the other actors around her.
So what's he saying? Is it something in her expressions? Is it something in her voice?
I would say it's in her expressions, considering what we know of how Garbo would act in Hollywood and how everyone was going on about, oh, once they get the lighting right, it's this complete transformation and she could put so much feeling into so little that's said.
Wow. Well, all right then. So it sounds like she's kind of beginning that stardom right now.
Not long after, Greta pondered changing her last name to something more refined and easily pronounceable for an international artist. Initially, Gabor was suggested, and then it was shortened to Garbo.
Which doesn't sound shorter to me. It's literally just rearrangement of the letters from a name that's actually a name that people have to a name that, as far as I know, is not a name that people have.
Well, I agree that it's probably not a name that people have, unless you're related to her and just decided to have the same made-up name. I'm not entirely sure if her niece did that at all or not at some point, off the top of my head anyway. But it just rolls off the tongue more easily.
Tell that to Zsa Zsa Gabor.
Well, she's not Greta Garbo.
She sure ain't.
However, she did not immediately leave school again. Instead, she continued studying at the academy. Studies soon ended when Stiller took her on a trip for the film premiere in Berlin, which was in the midst of literally a step beyond hyperinflation in the aftermath of World War I. While she was in Berlin, Stiller took off to Constantinople for the beginning production of a film that never saw the light of day. Immediately after, Garbo was cast in the Pabst's film, The Joyless Street, where it's possible she fainted backwards into Marlene Dietrich's arm for one scene.
Oh?
Supposedly, Dietrich confided late in life to a friend that she had been uncredited in the film, where she also dyed her hair and made references to scenes that were cut by the censor, namely something about her killing the butcher.
Ooh, okay. Scandalous film all around.
And though I say this like it's not a big deal, there was speculation the two had an affair, and it's documented that they avoided each other in Hollywood later on. The avoidance may have been because of how painful the end of that affair was, or because Garbo befriended Salka Vertel, who possibly knew Dietrich's dirty laundry.
Well, something's going on there.
There are also rumors of Dietrich insulting Garbo after the breakup and gossip spreading about this. That is all now left behind, because at 20, Garbo sails from Germany to the US with Stiller to work for MGM.
What happens in Berlin stays in Berlin.
You would hope.
I guess we'll see.
It's a bit like saying what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. It never actually does.
So, she's arriving in New York. Hot stuff, right?
No, there was no great fanfare when the ship docked. In fact, the two had to answer a variety of questions for the government on their health, sex, politics, and whether they supported polygamy or anarchy.
I wonder how many of our audience would get those questions right.
There's a part of me that suspects none.
Well, I guess leave a comment and let us know. Would the U.S. government let you into New York?
At this point, Garbo did not speak a word of English, so her days were soon occupied with a tutor while Stiller argued over contracts with the studio. A few weeks later, they left for L.A. via train. Garbo's contract kicked in as soon as they arrived. And now, there was some quibbling on the way there, as the U.S. legal age was 21 at the time. Garbo was still a minor, and thus could not sign her own contract.
Wait, what? How old is she?
20.
Oh, wow.
The contract had to be hastily sent to her mother in Stockholm to sign, which she did.
That's gotta feel a bit belittling.
I mean, there's a lot to feel rather belittling about when she first gets to Hollywood. She's sort of shoved here and there till they find a spot, which also took a few weeks. But she's finally placed in the film Torrent. Stiller, however, was not. He urged Greta to accept it, though, and so she did. This did not help her nerves. She didn't know how to cope with a different director. In fact, it said that she approached her first Hollywood film with the enthusiasm of a prisoner being frog marched to the electric chair.
Oof. I mean, yeah, she's 20, she's in a foreign country where she's just now learning to speak the language, and the one person she came over with can't be involved with this creative project.
And no, and to add on to it, it took a bit to find... Essentially, it took a bit to find the correct lighting guy, William Daniels, to bring out the Greta Garbo mystique that she would then bring to all her film roles. However, thankfully, the filming wrapped after only 23 days. Thank God for silent films. While the movie proved a success in early 1926, Garbo was not happy. She was bored, stuck in a contract that she didn't entirely understand, and really just wanted to go home.
Aww.
Being arrested for speeding probably didn't help. But as friends noted, as soon as she learned to drive, she was a speed demon. In this case, being an actress had its perks. Instead of 3 days in jail, Garbo only had to pay a $10 fine.
Oh, wow. At least she's getting privileged now after that crummy childhood. And look, I don't condone speeding, but this is the 20s, so speeding is like, what, 40?
I don't know from cars. Does Google know?
I know that, like, legit, like, normal car driving was, like, 20 miles per hour or something like that. Like, the speeds that we get up to today on the highway were, like, completely unheard of.
So, supposedly, at least in the year 1920, the Ford Model T had a top speed of 28 miles per hour. So, definitely no more, I'd say, than 50.
So, I don't think she's canceled. She's not canceled in my book. She can speed as much as she wants.
You may regret that as cars get faster.
Yeah.
The success of Torrent meant MGM continued to cast Garbo in roles as a seductress temptress. The next film began with Stiller as director, but he was replaced as the film ran over budget and time. A press release lied that he had been replaced due to illness. Meanwhile, Garbo was upset at him leaving, and none of Stiller's shots were placed in the final movie.
That sounds like kind of a scorched earth strategy.
To me, it sounds like the film was completely changed alongside the director. In fact, Stiller's work visa was not extended by MGM. Paramount took him instead. The release of the new film then came with news of her sister's death in Sweden. She didn't want to immediately start work on the next film, Flesh and the Devil, opposite the actor John Gilbert. However, she bowed to the studio pressure and the news coverage that declared Garbo go home, because she wanted some time off. Some people believed that Gilbert and Garbo meeting on the set was love at first sight. They even planned to get married in 1926, it was said. It was to be a double wedding with another Hollywood couple. Either way, Garbo didn't show up. Matters were not helped when Louis B. Mayer told Gilbert to just fuck her and move on rather than marry her.
Excuse me?
Gilbert hit him for that.
Mm-hmm.
The incident probably largely contributed to the end of the actor's career years later, as Mayer was known to hold grudges. However, Some question whether that marriage was even going to take place. No one appears to have produced a marriage license for Gilbert and Garbo for that date. Only one for the other couple has surfaced. Most put this down to faulty memories and mixing dates rather than anything else. However, that is not to say that marriage talk never occurred. Gilbert, later on, did beg her to marry him, though for a time she wavered.
I don't know how to put this. Do we know if Garbo liked men?
After all that I've read in the documentaries I've seen, I am only convinced that she was not straight. I cannot say for certain if she actually liked Gilbert or just sort of strung him along.
Interesting. I mean, I guess you do what you can.
In the meantime, Greta chafed at being typecast. At one point after the film with Gilbert, she was suspended from MGM for bluntly stating to a director that she didn't want to work for him. Gilbert encouraged her rebellion against the studio. She won in the end, getting a say in her roles and a hefty pay raise in later years, all because she was indifferent to all their threats. Send her home? That'd be great. Only throw her into bad pictures for the rest of her contract? That's fine. She wasn't ambitious for the best of their films anyway, if it meant being typecast. Obviously, the studio heads were terrified when they realized they couldn't bully her into submission like they were used to. Like, did you know that MGM routinely leaked false, scandalous stories to the press in order to get the U.S. immigration people to reject extending foreign actors' visa applications?
No, I did not know that. But man, this is reason enough to support actors' unions and actors' organizing, right?
I am not aware of an actors' union in the late 1920s.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's, if there had been, or if what they had was any good, they wouldn't have had this problem. And today, we don't stand for that.
Anyway, after battling MGM, rumors spread that Gilbert and Garbo had married. They had not. He continued to ask her to marry him at intervals. She continued to say no. This roundabout went on for a time until Gilbert finally gave up. He ended up marrying a different actress.
Good for him. That didn't sound like it was going to pan out.
By 1928, Garbo was firmly entrenched as an actress in Hollywood, and she was still going to parties. It was at one of these that she met the up-and-coming but very wild actress Louise Brooks, who would be kicked out of Hollywood only to briefly find success in Europe as Lulu in Pandora's Box. They sat drinking, talking, and laughing. Brooks later wrote that Garbo's gaze was so intense and eloquent that she left after an hour when she intended to stay the whole afternoon.
She got so flustered.
She also said they had a one-night stand and described Garbo as a charming and tender lover. After a trip to Sweden in 1928, Greta returned to Hollywood and ended up in a more international conclave, headed by the actress Salka Vertel. Her celebrity status was also a problem more than before. Fans gathered at every entrance of the hotel she lived in, all hoping for a glimpse and an autograph. One girl even threw herself in front of the actress's car while she was driving. Hollywood at this time even was not familiar with such obsession. As a result, Garbo moved to a house a friend picked out for her in the hills, which was publicly listed under someone else's name in order to hide.
Sounds like a good plan. It sounds like people are not being normal about this.
On the film end, sound would soon cause panic in Tinseltown. Garbo, in fact, was late to the transition. The studio was nervous she'd bomb like so many others, including her former co-star Ricardo Cortez, whom people once thought would be the new Rudolph Valentino. Eventually, she performed in the talkie Anna Christie, though she didn't even show up until about 10 minutes in. The studio was still very scared. They needn't have been. Audiences still loved her from the line, "Give me a whiskey, ginger ale on the side, and don't be stingy, baby." To which is now very obvious, I cannot interpret a Swedish accent. but hearing her voice added to the obsession of fans and hundreds of fan letters. Garbo, at this point, was still not interested in her own celebrity. She just didn't enjoy that spotlight and being chased around. On the other hand, that didn't mean her privacy was complete paradise. She ended up hopping from one house to another in order to keep away from prying eyes. Also, she may have had insomnia. She spent a lot of time reading at night because she couldn't fall asleep. By 1931, there were rumors Garbo would retire. With decreasing enthusiasm for films, she dealt with creative disappointment after creative disappointment from the studio. Dealing with crazies wouldn't have helped. One day, there was a fan who was completely convinced he was Garbo's brother, and he got arrested for stalking her in LA over several days. He was rather quickly sent back to his home in Idaho after the hearing. Meanwhile, theaters were closing across the US and the European market wasn't doing well at all. All in all, Garbo was quite melancholic by the time Mercedes DaCosta met her. Mercedes, as we mentioned in the previous episode, was a frequently struggling playwright who was lured to Hollywood with a contract to write films, which didn't actually happen. She also had a lover's list that rivals Natalie Barney's. According to one biographer, Garbo was attracted to Mercedes because Mercedes gave off a vibe of insecurity and a deep-seated need for attention, in addition to similar feelings of being different from everyone else. Now, I gotta ask you here, Pix. Thoughts, considering we just came from her episode?
I mean, that's kind of a red flag, right? Like, that's not very flattering. Oh, yeah, she's so hot. What with her insecurity and need for attention? I'm getting more of a sense of why this relationship didn't quite work.
This feels like the meaning behind that phrase, don't stick your dick in crazy. Like, yes, the sex will be great, but the relationship will suck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just doesn't seem like they're coming at this as, like, a partnership, you know?
So the two met through Garbo's friend Salka Vertel, but the hangouts were cut short by shooting for the film Susan Lennox. After that ended, they were together again. They took off to the Sierra Mountains for hiking, fishing, and swimming in a lake. The trip was short because Garbo needed to start work on Mata Hari soon after the previous film ended. Unfortunately, the papers started gossiping about how she had a new love, that the ambidextrous star was using her wiles again, that while she was noted for her softness and grace on screen, she'd been showing little concern lately for her appearance and wore masculine tweeds and slouch hats. Attempts to dislodge the rumors with such weak excuses as Garbo hung out with Mercedes because she loved the way she spoke English did not work.
Yeah, it seems like they've kind of made up their minds.
Such rumors were not helped by the fact Hollywood was perplexed by Garbo. They'd been trying to put her in one box or another for years. Innuendo and gossip compared her to a man, denying any femininity, while parallel strains of gossip did the opposite as well. It seemed to drive people mad that they couldn't figure her out. For publicity purposes, though, the studio would promote rumors of Garbo with the actor Ramon Navarro in the run-up to the release of the film Mata Hari. As the affair with Mercedes went the way of hot and cold, as discussed in a previous episode, I feel we should note something Louise Brooks once said. When someone like Dietrich or Bankhead went after her, Garbo took it on the lam. One biographer further speculated that Garbo preferred having even-tempered people around her in her private life as she did at work. And yet, as we noted last time, this thing with Mercedes turned into an on-and-off affair that lasted for decades. This included writing scripts which never saw the light of day, but also occasional funny moments. Like when Garbo told Mercedes she wanted to play the male title role of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, to which Mercedes said, "You go and tell Irving that idea, and have him throw you out the window, not me. You see, she'd gone to Irving Thalberg, a studio head, with a similar In Shock Factor idea for a film, and he'd quickly said no.
So this is interesting, because she does kind of want to do these masculine things. There is kind of a gender nonconformity happening here. Just maybe she doesn't want to be put into a box about it.
Yeah, so for instance, the role that Mercedes had pitched had actually been the same one that Sarah Bernhardt had done, along with Eva Logalien and Maude Adams. Can you guess which one I mean?
Who's to say?
L'Aiglon. So the title role of an originally French play where the actresses played the ill, sole surviving son of Napoleon Bonaparte, trying to flee his Austrian family in order to take up the throne of France.
Which sounds like a compelling part if she's given it, but whatever. Gotta maintain her image, I guess.
Speaking of work and running away from people, we all know Garbo as a famous recluse. She who spent her last years alone haunting the streets of New York City. But that's not quite the story.
Yeah, we've been hearing about her going to parties and things.
Many friends over the decades said she wasn't a shy person. They said at the start of her career, she lived like others with the typical social life and going out. However, as her fame progressed and people turned into nutcases, like the woman hitting her car windshield, Garbo retreated. She became cautious with social engagements.
I mean, understandably, right? You don't want to encourage them.
By 1932, it sounds like the fame and the curiosity of the public started driving her into isolation. She was also contemplating leaving Hollywood at the time, but the stock market crash hurt Sweden as well as the U.S., and at least she had a job in the U.S. She lost probably a couple hundred thousand, about 5 million today, according to inflation calculators.
Oof.
As a result, she negotiated a new contract with MGM for several years at $250,000 a film, which MGM didn't make public as they didn't want to let the other actors know in case they asked for higher salaries.
And this is why I always talk with your coworkers about how much you're making.
And this is how we get the film Queen Christina, which I personally love. Garbo doesn't ever get to play a man's role like Dorian Gray, but she does get to dress up androgynous and play a queen who in real life wasn't straight.
And was pretty gender nonconforming as well.
Yes, there's debate over whether or not Christina was trans, but there's a lot of ambiguity, both with the fact it's several hundred years in the past, and also with language. Only are you going from an older version of Swedish to modern, you are also translating into English. And if I remember correctly, they always insisted on calling the actual Christina king, because it meant to denote the position of power she had, whereas queen meant consort and broodmare. This was very much Garbo's project. She had a hand in practically every department while also being the star. In fact, she was the unofficial co-producer of the film. Now, she did play opposite John Gilbert in this film, and he had been out of MGM for years at this point. It was possible she rejected other candidates in order to force the studio to hire him after hearing how he had been cast out over what had really been Mayer's bad decisions during Gilbert's talkie debut. Remember, the two men traded blows over the studio head telling Gilbert to just fuck Garbo rather than marry her. The production cost just over $1 million, and then it was up against the Hays Code.
Which, if you haven't heard by some chance, was the production code that all of the movie studios agreed to act under, which they basically self-censored so that the government wouldn't come in and censor their films.
Yeah, it was this moral panic thing that was instituted. Now, the production code administration threw a fit over the characters played by Garbo and Gilbert staying in the same room at an inn because there was only one room and one bed that night. In the sequence where Queen Christina is disguised as a man outside the palace.
Anything could happen.
This, despite the fact no skin is shown, even let alone laying in the same bed.
No, there's just the implication.
Yeah, I'm more surprised there was no equal hissy fit over her kissing the maid and declaring to her chancellor on the subject of marriage, I shall die a bachelor.
Well, as we all know, women don't have their own desires. We can just hand wave that.
Tell that to the queens of history. Anyway, the film was only cut according to the New York censor recommendations, and then released without a code production seal.
Oh, how come?
The studio decided it wanted to play ball.
All right.
Probably partly in response to a positive public reception, a board soon after approved the film as abiding by the code. However, audiences were confused by the bisexual subtext, one biographer noted, and Garbo's appeal with men and small-town America declined.
Their loss.
It proved a pivotal shift in her box office draw, and therefore her money-making ability with MGM. It was also basically the end for Gilbert, who only made one more film after this, and without Garbo. There would be several films after Queen Christina. Some tried to harken back to Garbo's image as a glamorous seductress. There were also attempts to shift her to comedy, of which Ninotchka in 1939 is actually quite good. Sadly, its follow-up with Two-Faced Woman was not. Of course, that last film was also railed against by pastors for being indecent for making light of marriage.
Oh no!
In fact, she was now labeled box office poison. It also didn't matter that Sweden gave her an arts award. So as the U.S. entered World War II, and at almost 40, Garbo just left Hollywood. One friend said the film certainly threw her for a loop. At first, she still had her Beverly Hills home. Later, she moved to New York. After the war ended, she was invited to a screen test by the studio, but no movies were made. It's not as if there weren't offers during the war. David Selznick wanted her to portray Sarah Bernhardt, and this guy had even screen tested the old stage actress Maude Adams. Small world since we have done both these women in previous episodes. But Garbo turned down offers. This may have been in part due to the increasing Red Scare in Hollywood.
Did she have anything to worry about there? I mean, we've talked about how her actions were kind of proto-organizing, but was she actually a commie?
So here's the thing. It wasn't just about being a commie or not. When they had the un-American activities people out and about, they were also ferreting out and getting fired anyone who was not straight.
The Lavender Scare within the Red Scare.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a documentary called Lavender Scare even.
I should look it up. Yeah, I have heard that there is this thing of like, oh, if the communists find out that you're, you know, LGBT of some sort, that they'll blackmail you and make you a communist. Which, of course, the solution is make this person more blackmailable, right? Obviously.
But there's also the fact that it'd probably just be exhausting to live in such an environment. Now, all of that didn't mean she couldn't make films abroad after the war. Again, this never materialized, though. Negotiations for a part in a French film fell apart. Then there were visa problems for a British film. Essentially, things just never worked out. She didn't bend enough for producers, and she disliked the censorship of Hollywood. Meanwhile, she was also aging, which had no benefits for a career made on glamour and youth. From the 1950s onwards, Garbo spent her time living in New York and traveling abroad. She had a few friends and spent a lot of time walking as she got older. She also got pissed at Mercedes for her autobiography, Here Lies the Heart, because she felt someone could read between the lines about her being less than straight. She sometimes dined with politicians like JFK in the early 60s. Unfortunately for her, though, her fame didn't fade. There were still tons of fans. One of the new generation of filmmakers went so far as to say she achieved the status of a religious icon in the film industry.
Oof. Yeah, I'm sure people were behaving very normally toward her.
By the 70s, Garbo watching was a sport in New York City. Though some people wouldn't stare too much, thankfully, but others would follow her for several blocks, at which point she threatened to call the cops. She was in her 60s by that time, too. She also tried to stop the publication of a biography about her by Antony Granovich in 1977. Her court case over never having even met the man, let alone spoken to him for a book, shelved the biography at the time. It would be published after both their deaths. Fortunately or unfortunately, Garbo tended to have passing conversations about her career with journalists and writers in her later years. She did, after all, have some pride in what she'd done. It would lead to controversy, though, when it showed up in print.
Oh, how come?
For the same reason she didn't like that biography in 1977. But more interesting is the fact the King and Queen of Sweden came to visit her in New York in 1988, when they arrived on a trip to the States to celebrate the 350th year since the founding of New Sweden, a settlement from back when the U.S. was the colonies of various nations, and which, from what I can tell, was located along the border of Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Fun fact for those who don't know, New York was originally New Amsterdam, and it's interesting to see how the East Coast was originally carved up by Europe. Garbo was rushed by ambulance to the hospital the next year. Her kidneys had begun to fail. Now, she was released a few days later, but she refused to go on dialysis for her condition. While she did relent at the insistence of a friend, she ended up back in the hospital 6 months later with that friend and her niece. Garbo hung on till April 1990, when she died peacefully at her New York home. She was then cremated in New Jersey before, as per her wishes, being shipped back to Sweden. There was no triumphant homecoming for Garbo in Sweden in 1990 at her death, as there had been in 1928 or 1937, when she returned from Hollywood for several months at a time. No procession. No grand funeral. No funeral at all, in fact. At the time of a biography appearing in 1997, there had not even been a burial plot selected for her. So for several years, she went unburied.
How come? Seems like a bit of an oversight.
Her remaining family had not found a spot that fit their security precautions.
That's honestly so beautiful that they were dedicated to making sure she was secure and private and safe. It's kind of the opposite of a lot of these women who, you know, die in obscurity and it's really, really sad. But it's like, no, good. I'm glad she found some obscurity at last.
Well, she's not entirely obscure. She died famous. Like, she lived famous. So crazies would probably love to go to her grave and at least do Instagram selfies and stories.
At least her family could manufacture some privacy for her.
In the end, it's a very mixed bag of a life. There's a success on one hand and fame-driven seclusion on the other. As Garbo wrote to Cecil Beaton in 1948, "What a waste of the best years of my life. Always alone. It was so stupid not being able to partake. Now I'm just wandering, living a life apart." And yes, I did change that last bit of the quote, if you want to look up the actual original. I'm assuming this refers to both the years doing film and being hounded by nutcases because of said films, but who knows? Like all the dead, she doesn't pick up the phone, and I really doubt she'd do so while alive either. In fact, I don't think you'd be listening to this podcast otherwise. Thanks for listening. Follow us on your podcast app of choice for more mostly sapphic history. If you're on YouTube, please like, subscribe, and comment, and follow us on Twitter for quotes from your favorite sapphic historical figures completely out of context and the memes we create about them. And remember, never be famous.